All right, so settling into your meditation posture. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. So bring the attention inside. What does that mean for you? Does that mean feeling your body or being aware of your thoughts or being aware of emotions? With mindfulness practice, of course, it can mean any or all of those things. But it seems most useful to start with the body, the least subtle of those aspects of experience. So maybe easier to feel to start our practice. Oh, letting the body settle. Releasing the shoulders. Softening the belly. And letting the jaw release as well, relaxing so that you're not holding tension in your face. Just sensing any tension just draining out of the body, just a sense of really being drawn to the earth, grounded. And then tuning in as well to the felt experience of mood, emotion in the body, the more subtle energy. So this is a kind of just generalized observation of your present moment experience, the body, the mood, maybe sounds. But then we can focus on the breath to give ourselves a very particular meditation object, a focal point, a concentration point. So you can pay attention to the breath at the nostrils, the touch of air coming and going. Or if it's easier, you can just pay attention to the movement of the belly rising and falling. We're asking ourselves in a way to simplify the mind in this practice. Just be with breathing. Our minds are so used to busyness, thinking, planning, remembering, analyzing, calculating. And then when there's any space, we often fill it up with entertainment or reading, or some distraction. It's interesting to see what happens when we ask the mind to do a much more simple task, to just pay attention to the breath. It can be like trying to calm a squirming child. The mind seems almost desperate for distraction, for activity of some kind. So with mindfulness, we can actually turn our attention to that energy, that restless energy, at the same time that we feel the breath. We're not fighting with the energy, trying to push it away or suppress it. In a way, we're respecting it, allowing it to come through. But we try to do that from this vantage point of mindfulness of the breath. Let's see if you can hold the two, if your mind is busy in this way. If you can hold that busyness with the breath at the same time. That can take different forms. Could be a kind of alternation, swinging back and forth between the busy mind and the quiet breath. Or it could take the form of what feels like a more expansive mind, one that contains both. All right. Nice to see everyone. It's a little strange to be out of the Berkeley bubble where people don't wear masks. I have been trying to figure out why people want to die, but I don't know. So I don't want a better note, happier note. Let's see now, where was I? And maybe that was, I didn't mean to offend anybody. I just, I'm very cautious. We have been, we've been going through one breath at a time now since March of 2020, and just, you know, kind of realizing that it's almost getting to the point where that reference point of when this started is fading out in sort of relevance anymore. Because I think there was this sort of feeling that, like, oh, we're starting this thing and then it's going to end. And it's like, oh, maybe not. Maybe this is going to go on for a long time, or forever, whatever, ever, whatever. Anyway, we've been in step 10, and we're in the last section of step 10 that I call maintaining joy. And it's kind of, it's not exactly something we would relate to step 10. It has to do, I think that title for the section, excuse me, more comes out of using the talking about the last three steps as the maintenance steps. And so I kind of expanded on that to bring in this question of joy, which I think is a really important topic for people in recovery in any case. And I thought that I would actually digress a bit into my book that's on the topic of joy called Recovering Joy. And as I was looking for it on my computer, I found the original title was Finding Joy in Recovery. And I wish I'd have kept that title. If you're writing a book, trust your first idea for the title. Don't overthink it. I thought I would read a little bit from Recovering Joy, and this is actually one of the chapter after the introduction. The first chapter is called Not Unhappy, which was one of my ideas for the title of this book, which I kind of like. But anyway, we don't have to talk about book titles. Oh, that was another idea for the title. Anyway, I'll just read some of this and then talk about it. When you hear the word happiness, you probably have your own sense of its meaning. Before I got sober, I thought it meant something like being in a good mood all the time or having loads of fun with no responsibilities. That's not how I define happiness now. In fact, several years ago, when stuck in a long period of difficult moods, depression, and irritability, I found myself saying, I'm depressed, but I'm not unhappy. What did that mean? What I was saying was that nothing was wrong with my life. I was healthy, had a loving family that I adored, and found great satisfaction in my work. I understood by that time in my life that troubling moods seemed to be a persistent, if intermittent, part of my life, but that they didn't impinge on the essential value and meaning of my life or the satisfaction I derived from my life. I think it has partly been this attitude towards moods that allowed me to be less controlled by them. So obviously I'm saying that happiness isn't just a mood. That doesn't mean we can be happy without ever being in a good mood. certainly having access to joyful and uplifting feelings on a fairly regular basis is part of what I'd call happiness. But happiness is more than that. I think it includes and depends upon the following elements, which are also the main chapters of this book. Integration of values and behavior. That is, we live up to our own moral and ethical standards without shadow behaviors. We're not hiding any part of our lives from those close to us. These are bullet points here. Satisfying interpersonal relationships, be they with a partner, friends, family, or co-workers, our spiritual community, and our teachers, sponsors, and other healers. Satisfying work that both challenges us and allows us to use our intelligence and creativity to their fullest extent. Maybe I would say to a great extent, I'm not sure fullest is fair enough, but anyway. A sense of purpose and our own value. This may express itself through our work and how we see ourselves contributing to the world, or it may express itself in our relationships, the way we help and care for others. A healthy relationship to money and basic financial security, and good self-care of our bodies, including diet and healing. That's sort of meant to cover like the externals there. A rich inner life that includes a sense of connection to something greater than ourselves, be that a religious or spiritual connection, or simply a sense of connection with the human race, other beings, or just nature. This may include meditation or creative practice. Finally, then, an element of fun in our lives. As adults, many of us neglect this vital element of happiness. For addicts in recovery, this list in some sense provides a parallel process to the 12 steps. The steps require us to face our moral and ethical lapses. And they also show us how living with integrity is so much more easeful than otherwise. Certainly, most of us have had to do a lot of work repairing interpersonal relationships. Many of us have to spend years getting our work lives sorted out and straightening out our finances. As addicts, we often neglect our bodies and need to learn how to care for them in recovery. Spiritual connection is an essential part of the groundwork of recovery in the 12 steps, and learning how to have fun and play without intoxicants. And play without intoxicants is one of the first challenges of recovery. That kind of introduces the main themes of the book. As I said, it's kind of like the chapters, sort of, and it was sort of this intention. My effort was to, you know, try to a little bit demystify the idea of happiness and put it into really practical terms. Like, what can I do? Like, is it just something that I'm fated to be happy or unhappy, or I'm just lucky? But instead, is it possible to like kind of look at the things in my life that contribute to or, you know, take away from happiness, and can I cultivate those things that bring more happiness? And it's also sort of, again, sort of taking it also out of just the, as I say, just out of the idea of a mood, but that happiness is something sort of greater than just moment by moment emotions, and has something to do with a sort of integrated and sort of holistic life that seems to work on multiple levels. And that's not to suggest that, you know, it's ever going to all be working perfectly on all those levels, but we can really work at these things. And you know, certainly for addicts, the first thing that I talk about, the idea of living with integrity, you know, is the starting point of recovery, you know, because addiction is a sort of, by definition, lacking in integrity. That's like an understatement, you know, and all the things that it triggers. Interestingly, there's a little side note on this. I was talking about this with a precepts recently. The five precepts: not to kill, not to steal, not to harm sexually, not to lie, not to use intoxicants, The first four are considered to be sort of morally unambiguous, that you know, that you simply can't do them without creating harm. Using intoxicants is said to, it's not in and of itself a moral issue, but it has this effect, most importantly, probably, of making us more likely to break the other precepts. We're more likely to harm people or to act out sexually or to lie or to steal. And, you know, so one of the things I think that people outside the recovery world don't understand is that when we work the 12 steps, we're not just like turning our lives over to God, you know, or we stop drinking, you know, but it's really a complete overhaul of our moral life. And it's, we don't lie, cheat, and steal anymore. And at least that's the suggestion, you know, people might still do that, but so the Buddha has this term for this, which my favorite translation of it is the bliss of blamelessness. So I like the alliteration, but the bliss of blamelessness is really it's a really interesting phrase, you know, and typically of Buddhism, it's like the happiness that comes from not doing something, right? The sort of, you know, letting go, right? That's the way to happiness in Buddhism. It's not acquiring something. It's not by doing something really special. Like, I was just so nice to people, which is great. And of course, that's a way to happiness too, being kind. But the starting point of just like, cut out the harmful stuff. And there will actually be maybe not bliss in every moment, but a certain kind of peace that comes with knowing that, oh, I'm not harming people. I'm not breaking the law. I'm not lying and having to cover my tracks. You know, I'm not feeling guilty. You know, just that is a great starting point for happiness. And where mindfulness is really important in this process is to notice when you're happy, right? Because like, if you're anything like me, which hopefully you're not, you know, there's a tendency to focus on the negative, you know, and like, forget to notice that like, hey, things are good right now. Things are okay, you know? And so that mindfulness of just being present with, what am I feeling right now? And maybe I'm not feeling bliss, but I'm just feeling relief. You know, we had that experience yesterday. Like, we had to prepare the house. And when I say we, I mean my wife and me as a like assistant. And we can go into the dynamics, the unfortunate dynamics of that, but we won't. But you can just guess. I gave you enough hint. But you know, prepare the house for the painters to come, which meant we had to clean out a lot of stuff to make space, and then getting packed, and we're leaving. And I'm a little bit neurotic about packing because I don't like to forget stuff. And when I'm traveling in a car, then I just take everything I could possibly want so that I don't just pile in it. You know, there's that feeling you get in the car and you start going, it's like, oh, that's over. You know, it's like Naroda, like the emptiness is like, the space, what a relief. And, you know, just to take joy in that, right? Like, okay, we're in the car, we're going, you know. Just to notice the joy, you know, notice the subtlety of joy, which again, for addicts, it's like we numbed ourselves in a way And maybe, you know, maybe that part of that came out of our own pain, of out of trauma or whatever, that even before we started using intoxicants, we needed to shut down. And that can be a big part of recovery too, is healing on that level. But certainly in the activity of addiction, we were suppressing feelings, which meant in a way we had to do more in order to feel happy. You know, we had to, it's like, I got to be drunk before I notice that I feel good. You know, I've got to be really loaded to get my own attention. There's very little subtlety of awareness. So in recovery, and particularly if we bring mindfulness in recovery, we can start to appreciate these smaller moments, right? I had forgotten about this thing in my book, Recovering Joy. It's kind of I can see why I forgot it, because it's kind of silly, but it's kind of cutesy. But there's a practice I have at the end of this first chapter called One Pleasant Thing, and then I'm calling it OPT. I don't know what made me think like this, but sometimes writers get deluded. But the idea of it I like, which is this very simple idea of it's a practice that sometimes all it takes to make a shift in mood is to notice something you can enjoy right now. I call this practice One Pleasant Thing. And very often, this for me is just like stepping outside, you know, and these days it seems like spend even more time inside, because there's sort of less activities to do. And so like that going outside and just going, oh, air, trees, a breeze, the sun or clouds or rain or something, you know, that just being touched, just feeling life, feeling the planet, feeling the earth. And of course, it doesn't have to be that. There's many ways that we can sort of find just a simple thing to break through, you know, just to break through. And our meditation practice can be that too. Just the, you know, to tune into the subtle joy of the breath. You know. In the next practice that I have in here is the smile practice, which I did that. I don't know how many of you were at the day long on Saturday that I did with Vimala Sara, but I did some version of this meditation where you smile as you're meditating. And this is kind of like, instead of doing it, instead of sort of expecting your good mood to make you smile, you actually see if smiling can help your mood. And yeah, this is a little bit tricky, because it doesn't work if you're like, I'm gonna be in a good mood, god damn it, you know. But it works. To me, it kind of works when you're like a neutral, or just maybe a little below neutral, and you're kind of like, eh, and just kind of taking a breath and smiling. You don't have to close your eyes, but kind of like, oh, and you know, it's one of those things. I know I've read about research that shows that actually smiling intentionally can change the mood, that it activates something. I'm not very educated about the brain science. There's others here who I think probably know more, but it's not so important. I mean, I think it can be helpful to realize, oh, this isn't just me making this up. It's like, yeah, there actually is some research that shows that. And so it gives you a little more confidence in saying, okay, it's not just stupid. I'm not just like faking it. It's like, oh, So I actually have, that actually has become habituated, that I often just smile, and I'm someone who does not naturally smile. In fact, it's interesting when I see myself smiling in photographs, when I'm intentionally trying to smile, I often look like I'm grimacing. I'm like, wow, but because it's just sort of not. So I had to train myself to do it. But now I find that I often just, like, without even intentionally knowing I'm doing it, just kind of, I smile, and, you know, in many, many little situations where it's just like, sort of, I need that, or it's just sort of my response to even the neutral state. So yeah, this idea, this larger idea, I guess, of that we don't have to depend on the circumstances of our lives. We don't have to get something. Nothing particular has to happen for us to feel joy, for us to feel happiness. That it's something that's accessible to us much of the time. And that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be times when it's just like not possible, you know, like, okay, this is just miserable, or I hate this, or I'm in pain, or I'm really sad or grieving, you know, all of that is part of life, but also just not feeling like you're the victim of life, and that, you know, you kind of, feel like, well, you know, life sucks and then you die kind of attitude, you know. And I think, you know, there's a lot of that out there. And again, I think as addicts, we can easily succumb to those kind of feelings. So I think there is a certain responsibility, actually, to cultivate happiness in our lives, and to see what we can do and to create a sense of happiness. And I think it does begin somewhat with a kind of definition of, like, well, what does this mean for me? You know, what would happiness look like? How do I view happiness? And then asking, am I happy? And then, of course, then if not, what in what way, or, you know, what, why am I unhappy, and what do I need to do about that? You know, and this is, again, not to discount things like clinical depression, or trauma, anxiety, that are real issues that have to be dealt with sometimes, you know, therapeutically. So I may go back to this section of the book. I'm kind of thinking this Friday I'm teaching at Spirit Rock, so I think I might continue the topic of joy for the rest of the week, for Friday night as well. But I just thought I would sort of play with that a little bit today. So let me just open it up to see if there are any thoughts or comments or questions.
Yeah, Kevin, it's me again, Cameron.
Hi, Cameron.
Hey, everyone. So this reminds me of one time I asked you, I remember, what you thought the God of NA or AA was. And I still have that question. You know, the steps there kind of seems to be a vacuum in them intentionally, where they're kind of void of content. And sometimes I tell people, when I try and help them approach the steps, that they have to fill in that empty content to be able to actually practice those steps, because they're empty. There isn't a clear you know, set of principles or moral code in there. There's no effort. And so, I remember you said it was that you thought maybe it was kind of a feeling that if you could identify a similar concept of God that branches all across AA as a group, that it might be something like a feeling, and that it was possibly dangerous, that there may be that if that feeling is gone, then we might interpret that there's no higher power. Where is higher power if that feeling is absent? Right. So that's kind of a danger that reminds me of that. I still have that question, and I still wonder, you know, what's the answer there?
My first question to you is, why do you need an answer to that question?
Well, I don't know. It just presents itself. It's kind of one of the problems I have with AA. Some things bother me about AA. It's one of the reasons why I keep trying to move myself away. And that's one of the things that bothers me, that everybody believes something different, that there's that it's kind of like, you know, I was in a meeting on Zoom. I was in an AA meeting on Zoom, and one young lady was talking about her Christian background and how when she works through the steps, all of that informs her experience of the steps. And then she was saying, and I think she was right on, she says that there's kind of a broad atheist bent, especially currently in AA, is what I'm noticing. There's a broad atheist bent in AA. And so when someone like that, with that kind of an inclination goes into the steps, then that's their experience of the steps. It's all about God as we understand him, and how can we, you know, adjust that to match our own inclinations. And so, I mean, it's confusing. That's why I have that. I want an answer, because it's confusing to me.
I mean, the reason I asked you that, Cam, is just because it does say in the steps, as we understood him, and the implication being that all we really have to concern ourselves with is finding our own understanding, rather than figuring out what other people's understanding is, or if there is some sort of generic 12-step understanding of higher power or God. It's striking to hear you say that there's like an atheist bent in AA now. I'm not very involved in AA on a regular basis at this point. One of the main reasons I wrote One Breath at a Time was because of all the people who were frustrated with the God, you know, the Christian tone of AA. So I think it falls under the category of it's always something, you know. So there's always going to be these different interpretations. But ultimately for me, the question isn't, you know, how to, and I'm not sure this is the question you're asking, but it's not for me, how do I define God, but it's rather, how do I work the steps using my own spiritual tools and my own spiritual understanding, you know, and if I can do that, if I can figure out a way to do that, then I'm fine, you know, I can work the steps, and if I can't, then I need to reconsider what I'm doing, whether either reconsider my spiritual understanding or reconsider whether the steps are really going to work for me. And is there some other process I need to be engaged in?
Yeah, thank you. Well, I like it here, so I just keep coming. Thank you.
I like having you here. Thank you. So there were a couple of hands up. Steve.
Good morning, Kevin. Couple of things. First, I want to pay my gratitudes for the time that you had spent with me and Vimalasara at the day long on Saturday. I just came away from that really struck. And the teachings are finally starting to really resonate with me. I'm kind of a slow learner, but wow. And my compliments to both of you for it was just a wonderful day. I'd never done a day long like that sponsored by Spirit Rock. And interestingly enough, I know that the host had mentioned that, you know, they're having the on-land retreats again. And I happened to be on that list of the waiting list for the first one. And she said that there was, you know, 80 openings and 800 people had signed up for that. And so I get up at 4 a.m. and every day I got online, and then Sunday there was another offering. And I have to tell you, I just had my credit card in hand and I jumped on and I signed up for a retreat in October and I was able to get in. So,
all right.
Yeah, I haven't been to Spirit Rock for probably 30, 35 years. I remember sitting there many years ago, just in this one room with Jack and Ram Dass. And it was like, well, I'm looking back at my history. But when I was reading the daily readings out of your book, I came across that whole thing about the smiling. And I've been trying to do that. I have a heck of a time. The only one I've seen do that consistently is Tara. Tara Brock, when she's teaching, I don't know how she does it, you know, keep that little smile on her face. But I have to say that it works. I mean, this morning I was just I'm really starting to feel recovery. And, you know, at the end of this day on Saturday, Vimalasara had made a remark to me that has really stuck with me. And I wanted to share that was, after all the work that we had done together, she told me that no matter what, if I don't take anything else away from the session, the day long, just realize that you're not a bad person because you're a chronic relapser. That has really stuck with me. So I just wanted to share that because I'm really starting to feel the recovery, and I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing. And I'm very, very happy to be involved with this Sangha. That means a lot to me. So thank you.
I think the maids are coming to the door to kick us out. Maybe one more. It's either Abigail or Joe. I don't know who had their hand up first. So you guys can fight it out.
I just wanted to say one thing about the smile thing.
Yeah.
In the whole gatha, he says, breathing in, we smile. Breathing out, we release. And I think I heard him expand on that at one point, but I could be wrong. It could have been somebody else. And his idea was that breathing in, we smile, like with a big grin. Breathing out, we release and just leave a little bit.
Oh, nice.
And
I never heard that. Yeah.
It's like I have this change in feeling. That the big smile changes things, and then the release, just settles. Mm. So I may have made that up completely, but I like it.
You know, that's how things happen, you know? You just make stuff up, and then it comes out into the universe. I like it. Thanks, Abigail. Okay. Joe, can you drop in here quick?
I think so. I was just going to say that this whole thing about God and so forth, I think to some extent relates to control. And in some sense, if you can turn it over to God, you can stop trying to control yourself. And my experience is that controlling myself doesn't actually work. And I think that's sort of what they're saying, you know, we're powerless in some sense to control ourselves. And and I don't know if I needed to believe in God per se. You know, it was enough for me to realize that the Buddha was onto something. I don't think of the Buddha as being God. I think of him as being enlightened, and that enlightenment is possible for everyone. So that was enough. You know, then I could sort of get, no, well, you understand what I'm saying? Get out
of my own head. I'm sorry, but I'm just feeling a pressure to close.
Thank you.
And I want to give Jonathan a chance to chime in because he's got his hand up.
Thanks, Kevin. I was just curious about like what that one pleasant thing practice, is that like more specifically focused on like something pleasant in the body, or is it just like basically a mini gratitude practice? If you could elaborate.
Yeah, I think it is like a mini gratitude practice. I think that's a good way of looking at it. I mean, it could take different forms, but gratitude or I like the term appreciation, because I have some complicated relationship with the word gratitude, but which I would have to explain, but I don't have time. But a moment of appreciation, a moment of gratitude. I think that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. And just keeping it simple. Yeah. That's
great. Thank you.
That's a good way to close. Thank you for saying that. All right, you guys, really thank you all. Really good to see people. And you're going to catch me with a different background next time. So, for what it's worth.